headlines, Iran says there is nothing secret about new constructions at Natanz site and that the IAEA is fully informed of its efforts. Israeli fighter jets bomb positions in central and eastern Gaza. Hamas says Palestinians will keep resisting. Also coming up, reports say the U.S. is expanding its illegal military bases in eastern Syria. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisumisha Ahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. Iran says it has already informed the International Atomic Energy Agency of new construction around Natanz nuclear facility. The spokesman for the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran says it is moving its centrifuge manufacturing plant to a site near Natanz for security reasons. Behruz Kamalvandi says the relocation is part of measures to tighten security around nuclear facilities. They come after the terrorist operation that damaged the centrifuge plant in Karaj last year. Earlier, the New York Times reported that Iran is constructing new facilities deep under mountains that are able to withstand bunker-busting bombs and cyber attacks. A U.S. think tank says Israel's strategy on Iran has been a total failure, warning that Tehran's sharp response to the regime's provocations could spark a regional confrontation. In an article on its website, the Atlantic Council says there is a growing gap between the statements of senior Israeli officials and the reality on the ground. It says a recent report by the UN's Atomic Energy Agency reveals the depth of Iran's progress in its nuclear program, despite Israel's efforts to thwart it. The futile endeavors include various covert operations, such as sabotage and assassinations, and a threat to bomb Iran's nuclear installations. The piece also said that Iran's oil revenues under the current sanctions regime illustrate the failure of the Israeli-backed U.S. maximum pressure campaign against Tehran. Journalist and political analyst Aid Mohsin Abbas tells us how Israeli belligerence has resulted, in a more powerful and advanced Iran.
Well, I think it's been an abject failure, quite clearly, in spite of the fact that they have had the ability to occasionally assassinate in cold blood scientists, you know, Mohsin Fakhrizadeh being the most prominent. They've had the audacity to also reach out and basically target kill Hassan Saeed Khodai, an IRGC officer who was in charge of missiles programs. And so, of course, what they're doing is they're extending their exceptionalism that they have to go out and assassinate and kill Iranians wherever and whenever they wish. Of course, Qasem Soleimani, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, was the prime case of that happening as well. However, what has it achieved? Everything Israel has done in terms of trying to eradicate Iran's ability, its national sovereign right, in fact, to self-defense through missiles programs, through nuclear energy even, all of these things are part of the norm of the civilized world. But what has Israel achieved by all this? In fact, they've just accelerated, first of all, the process of Iran's commitment to increasing its security power, its military and technology power. They've accelerated Iran's necessity to defend its borders, and Iran is very capable of doing that through asymmetric warfare, which was something which the Israelis and the Zionist American alliance did for many, many years before. And the Iranians' Quds Force, the IRGC's Quds Force, has achieved huge victories on every arena that it's come up against the Zio Western imperialist empire. So, in fact, everything that they've been doing has just backfired constantly, and even cyber attacks, Iran is able to give pound-for-pound responses, and they have been doing this.
Today marks the fifth anniversary of an Iranian retaliatory missile strike on Daesh terrorists. In June 2017, the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps fired missiles at a group of positions in Syria in response to the terror attacks in Tehran, which were claimed by Daesh.
The moments when Iran launched missiles from inside its territory toward Daesh terrorists' positions in eastern Syria. The Islamic Revolution Guards Corps said it fired surface-to-surface medium-range missiles into Syria's Deir ez-Zor province from its air force bases in the western provinces of Kurdistan and Kermanshah. The IRGC announced that many Daesh terrorists were killed in the strikes, adding that a large amount of their weapons, ammunition, and systems were also destroyed. The IRGC said in a statement that the missile strikes were in retaliation for the Daesh-claimed terror attacks in Tehran, which killed 18 people. The statement warned Daesh and its regional and international supporters of the consequences of carrying out terror raids against the Iranian nation.
The message of this revolutionary and punitive measure is crystal clear. The Islamic Revolution Guards Corps warns the Tekfiri terrorists and their regional and transregional supporters that they will be engulfed in the revolutionary wrath and the flames of revenge of the guardsmen of the revolution if they repeat their evil acts against the Iranian nation.
Experts say the missile strikes showed Iran's military might in fight against terrorists.
This attack showed Iran's wide variety of choices that it has with regard to the fight against terrorism, especially ISIL. It showed both the terrorists in Syria and elsewhere, as well as their supporters, that Iran has a wide variety of options available in order to hit back and also in order to control the war in Syria.
The Islamic Republic has been leading the fight against terrorism by helping the Iraqi and Syrian governments in their battles against Daesh and other terrorist groups. The Iranian officials have time and again stressed that had Iran not stood against the hot spot of terrorism in the region, the country would have faced severe security problems. This was the first time Iran launched retaliatory missile strikes against terrorists outside its soil. Tehran says it reserves the right to take further steps against terror groups if they seek to cause insecurity in the country.
The Israeli military says it has struck Hamas military sites in the besieged Gaza Strip. The military says that the airstrikes were in response to rockets fired from Palestinian territory. No group in Gaza has confirmed that claim, but Hamas has reacted to the strikes, saying they are part of a continued Israeli aggression. Ashraf Shannon has the details.
The Israeli fighter jets carried out a number of airstrikes against Hamas security post in the Gaza Strip since the early hours of today, completely destroying several of these posts in the east of the enclave and east of Gaza City, and also east of the northern Gaza Strip town of Beth Hanun. These airstrikes and attacks come only about less than a day after Israeli drones attacked the Gaza Strip as well as tanks. Regarding today's attacks, the Israeli regime alleges that a rocket that was fired from Gaza and hit the city of Ashkelon in the north of the Gaza Strip, although no one has confirmed in Gaza firing rockets. Meanwhile, Hamas spokesman Hazem Qasem reacted to the airstrike, saying that these Israeli attacks is a continuation of the Israeli aggression against Palestinians all over Palestine. And he said that the Palestinian resistance will continue to fight the Israeli occupation until the liberation.
The United States is reportedly expanding its illegal military bases in Syria, reinforcing them with air defense systems. Russia's Sputnik News agency says the U.S. is building up its military in eastern Syria, expanding positions there and relocating military convoys. The agency says American forces have set up bases where they have now launched modern radar systems. The U.S. has kept its presence in Syria despite strong opposition from the Damascus government. Syria says the U.S. is looting its resources under the guise of fighting terrorists. Syria is also opposed to Turkey's presence on its soil. That has recently come to the spotlight again as Turkey has announced plans for a military operation in northern Syria. Ankara says it aims to eliminate Kurdish groups, which it views as terrorists. Now to Afghanistan, where three explosions have struck a Sikh temple in the capital, Kabul. A temple official says at least 30 people were inside the building when the blasts happened. The Taliban have not yet confirmed the explosions. No word on possible casualties or claims of responsibility either. Witnesses say gunfire ensued after armed men attacked the temple. On Friday, at least one person was killed and seven others wounded in a bomb blast in the northern Kunduz province. It hit a mosque during Friday prayers. A string of bombings claimed by the Daesh terror group has targeted religious sites in Afghanistan in recent months. The U.S. president shrugs off criticism over an upcoming meeting with the Saudi crown prince on the sidelines of the Persian Gulf Cooperation Council summit, despite the kingdom's poor human rights record.
Yeah, but when you go to Saudi Arabia,
the same way I've been handling it. I'm not going to meet with MBS. I'm going to an international meeting, and he's going to be part of it. Just like there were people part of the discussion today.
Saudis, however, say Biden will hold a one-on-one meeting with Mohammed bin Salman during his planned trip to Riyadh in July. U.S. lawmakers, including some Democrats, have criticized the visit, citing his promise to put human rights at the heart of his foreign policy. Rights advocates also say Biden's trip could embolden Saudi Arabia to crack down on dissidents abroad and restrict civil liberties democratically. Moving on, the Russian president has warned that Ukraine will turn into a semi-colony of Western countries if it goes ahead with joining the European Union.
The Ukrainian economy is structured in such a way that it requires very large subsidies and aid. And if it does not protect the international market, it will end up becoming a kind of semi-colony. This is my opinion. But at the same time, Ukraine will receive a lot of support for current expenses.
Vladimir Putin issued the warning after the European Commission recommended giving Ukraine a candidate status for joining the EU. Putin, however, said Moscow has nothing against the country's possible membership of the bloc. Russian Foreign Ministry also accused the EU of manipulating Ukraine over its membership bid. Kiev's push is backed by the French, German, and Italian leaders, but launching accession talks requires unanimous approval from all EU member countries. Leaders of the 27-nation bloc are set to discuss the matter at a summit in Brussels next week. New information will be submitted to the court as WikiLeaks appeals the UK's decision to extradite the organization's founder, Julian Assange. Assange's brother says that the evidence includes a CIA plot to kidnap and assassinate the WikiLeaks founder and how his lawyers were subject to espionage. The abduction and assassination were reportedly plotted when Assange was holed up in the Ecuadorian embassy in London. He is currently held at a prison in London. Washington wants to put Assange on trial for the publication of confidential files in 2010 and 2011. They revealed how U.S.-led forces killed civilians in unreported incidents in Iraq and Afghanistan. WikiLeaks has called the U.K. government's decision to approve the extradition a dark day for freedom of the press and for British democracy. France is thinking over who they will vote for in this weekend's parliamentary elections, but a record abstention means that over half of the country is not even planning to vote. The low turnout may call into question France's democratic credibility and will likely hound President Emmanuel Macron's throughout his second term. Amin Mazahiri has more from Paris.
France's election season is coming to an end, with the second round legislative vote on June 19th set to determine if President Emmanuel Macron will have an easy parliamentary majority and thus free rein to continue his often autocratic control over the nation's political policies. Polls show Macron's coalition might fall just short of the 289 seats needed to control the National Assembly. However, his coalition is ideologically combined with the drastically reduced mainstream Conservative Party, so economic austerity and neoliberal ideas are polling to have around a dominant 340 seats.
For the first time,
any objective view of France today accepts that there is a fundamental change brewing in French politics, but there are still obstacles. Social movements have a new hope that things will not be as blocked as they were for the past 5 years.
Much like the blue wave of the United States Democrats in 2020, the NUPES alliance of left-wing parties seems certain to fall well short of its promises. They may wind up with only 30% of seats, could easily refracture into factions, and face an extremely united so-called bourgeois bloc.
For the first time in a long time, the left is united and behind a rupture with neoliberalism. The Social Party no longer dominates the left, and so there is no more leadership of a fundamentally right-wing economic ideology.
What appears certain is that turnout for the legislative elections will be the lowest not only in the history of the Fifth Republic, but also of the Fourth and Third Republics. The true majority winner of the legislative elections will almost certainly be abstention, with turnout expected to be as low as just 43%. Many say that such enormous abstention calls into question the democratic credibility of France's election. It's possible that the low turnout has been forced by Brussels, which for the past decade has ignored national elections to force through controversial changes. The high abstention makes it almost certain that Macron will lack a credible mandate for his programs. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
That brings us to the end of this edition of World News.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
in the limelight. After a white 18-year-old teenager wearing military gear and live streaming with a helmet camera opened fire with a rifle at a supermarket in Buffalo, New York, killing 10 people and wounding 3 others, U.S. President Joe Biden claimed racially motivated hate crime was abhorrent to the very fabric of the nation. We now present you an article written by Richard Luscombe. The piece is titled, "The Buffalo Mass Shooting Comes Amid Rise in Racial Violence in United States." The story is by now nauseatingly familiar. From Charleston to El Paso, Texas, from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania to San Diego, California, and from Christchurch, New Zealand to the latest scene of horror in Buffalo, New York, each of these mass shootings is stitched with one common thread: white supremacy. As investigators begin to piece together the details of last Saturday, May 14th, massacre at the Tops Friendly Market that killed 10 people, the motivation of the murderer already seems in little doubt. The perpetrator appears to be a radicalized, lone, white teenage gunman, filled with racial hatred fueled by extremist theory widely available on the internet, who descended on a predominantly black community in Buffalo, New York, heavily armed and determined to kill as many people as he could. The suspect, Peyton Gendron, an 18-year-old teenager, is said to have etched a racial insult onto the barrel of his assault rifle before he live-streamed himself gunning down grocery shoppers, supermarket staff, and a security guard. Authorities said he also posted a lengthy manifesto to social media with frequent references to a racist white replacement theory as justification for what they said was a hate crime and a racially motivated violent extremism. U.S. President Joe Biden, scores of American politicians and community and civil rights leaders, including the Reverend Al Sharpton, were quick to express their outrage, calling for more to be done to tackle the rise in hate-based crime in the United States. In a statement, President Biden said, "We still need to learn more about the motivation for the shooting as law enforcement does its work, but we don't need anything else to state a clear moral truth. A racially motivated hate crime is abhorrent to the very fabric of this nation." President Biden said, "Any act of domestic terrorism, including an act perpetrated in the name of a repugnant white nationalist ideology, is antithetical to everything we stand for in America. Hate must have no safe harbor. We must do everything in our power to end hate-fueled domestic terrorism." But it's a problem that has been getting worse in recent years, largely cultivated in the cauldron of the darkest reaches of the internet and eagerly seized upon by those all too willing to convert the skewed ideology into violence. The FBI reported last year that the hate crimes in the United States had risen to the highest level in 12 years, triggered largely by a surge in assaults on black and Asian Americans. And while mass murderers such as those in Buffalo, New York, and elsewhere understandably garnered the most attention, many thousands of other violent hate-based attacks take place each year, leading Attorney General Merrick Garland to make domestic terrorism and racially based hate crimes a top priority for the Justice Department. Derek Johnson, president of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, the NAACP, said in a statement following the Buffalo, New York attack, "Hate and racism have no place in America. We are shattered, extremely angered, and praying for the victims' families and loved ones, as well as the entire community." the parallels of Buffalo are significant not only to the August 2019 murder of 21 people at a Walmart store in El Paso, Texas, but also to countless other shooting incidents involving a radicalized, solitary attacker. In El Paso, Texas, the gunman, a 21-year-old white male, also posted a document online to extremist online message board 8chan, which stated the attack in the border town was a response to the Hispanic invasion of Texas. 4 years earlier, an attack on a black community church by a self-confessed white supremacist in Charleston, South Carolina, left at least 9 people dead. In October of 2018 in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, a white man shouted, "All of you must die," as he burst into the Tree of Life synagogue and shot dead 11 worshippers, as well as wounding 6 other individuals. And a similar mass shooting incident occurred at a synagogue in San Diego, California, in April of 2019, when one person died and several others were wounded by a 19-year-old teenager who also posted messages of racial hatred to 8chan. The San Diego killer claimed he was motivated by attacks on 2 mosques in Christchurch, New Zealand, a month earlier, in which a white supremacist murdered 51 Muslims. Investigators there quickly established the killer had been radicalized online, had posted his own manifesto of hatred, and live-streamed the killings. To Reverend Al Sharpton, the veteran civil rights activist and television host, the latest attack in Buffalo, New York, is an urgent call to action. Reverend Al Sharpton said in a tweet, "President Biden should have a White House meeting of black, Jewish, and Asian leaders to underscore the federal government's escalating efforts against hate crimes." Reverend Al Sharpton added, "These hate crimes need to be met with a united front against hate-based violence." Meanwhile, the mayor of Buffalo, New York, said on Sunday, 15th of May, he believed the murders in his city will prove a turning point. Byron Brown said on NBC's Meet the Press program, he said, "I would like to see sensible gun control in America. I would like to see ending hate speech on the internet, on social media. It is not free speech. It is not the American way." The mayor of Buffalo, New York, Byron Brown, claimed, "We are not a nation of haters. We are not a nation of hate. We need to send a message that there is no place in the internet for hate speech, for hate indoctrination, for spreading hate manifestos. I will be a stronger voice for that. I believe that what happened in Buffalo, New York yesterday is going to be a turning point. I think it's going to be different after this in terms of the energy and the activity that we see."
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
To Spotlight. Palestinians have held a funeral ceremony for 3 men shot dead by Israeli forces during a raid
on the Jenin refugee camp in the northern part of the West Bank. Nearly 80 Palestinians were also wounded in the ensuing clashes. Resistance movement Hamas says Israel will pay for its crimes, and the Israeli measures will only strengthen Palestinians' resolve to continue their resistance. Israel has in recent months intensified its attacks in the occupied territories. Jenin is the hardest hit following a series of anti-Israel operations by Palestinians there. The Palestinian Health Ministry says more than 60 Palestinians have been killed by Israeli forces this year, many of them in raids, incursions, and arbitrary killings by the Israeli army. On tonight's Spotlight, we have... Johannesburg. And also we have International Coordinator of the Samarin Palestinian Prisoner Solidarity Network, Charlotte Cates, joining us from Vancouver.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to the program, to the both of you. Let's start off with Mr. Ahmad Mayet in Johannesburg. Israel has in recent months intensified its attacks in the occupied territories. How do you view the recent wave of Israeli atrocities against Palestinians?
The situation in Palestine must be understood through two lenses, the first being the regional lens and the second being the domestic lens. The regional lens is very clear. Israel is still trying very hard to reestablish something called the deterrence equation. Israel was developed on the principle of deterrence, meaning the fear of the Arabs around them, and they thrive on this using excessive force. It was seen in Lebanon, in Dahiya, and they are trying very hard to reestablish that regional deterrence equation with the current activity with the gas platform off the coast of Lebanon. However, on the domestic front, Israel has somewhat reset the deterrence equation that was established by Saif al-Quds, the military operation, the 11-day operation that was waged against Israel in defense of Jerusalem. What we are seeing now, the massacres that are taking place within the occupied West Bank, the portion of Palestine occupied by Israel, with security cooperation by the Palestinian Authority, is a means of appeasing the Israeli population that they are doing something. And this is not my words. This is from Oret Parlov, who works for the INSS, who works for the Israeli Foreign Affairs Department, and is an advisor to the sellout states, the Arab states that have normalized ties with Israel. They are saying that this has no true effect on what they call their security concerns. It's merely a means of appeasing the Israeli population. Basically, Palestinian lives are being sacrificed to put smiles on occupier colonial settler faces. That's the summary of the situation.
Charlotte Cates, Jenin has been the hardest hit following a series of anti-Israel operations by Palestinians there. Also, there were some reprisal attacks, if you recall, against Israelis in the heart of Tel Aviv. Give us your perspective on the significance of these operations as Palestinians are venting their anger at the regime's crimes and occupation.
Well, it's very clear that despite 74 years, and indeed over 74 years, of Zionist colonialism inside occupied Palestine, what the occupation has failed to do through all of that time is to quash Palestinian resistance. And so we see that today. Certainly we see that in Gaza, where the resistance is perhaps stronger than it has ever been throughout the history of the Palestinian revolutionary movement. And it's also something that we see in Jenin. And Jenin, in many ways, has become a very dangerous symbol to the Israeli occupation, because the purpose of creating the so-called Palestinian Authority was to create a security coordination process and a tool, an agent of the colonizer to repress the resistance on behalf of the colonial force. And what we can see 30 years after Oslo is that this has entirely failed in quashing the will of the people to resist, and that despite all forms of assassination, torture, mass imprisonment, targeting, extrajudicial killings, that over and over again, the Palestinian people and their resistance organizations continue to rebuild, continue to mobilize. And so the mere existence of the Jenin brigades, of this ongoing strength and power of the armed resistance in Jenin, which comes hand in hand with all of the various forms of popular resistance practiced by the Palestinian people, it shows that Zionism has never been able to crush Palestinian resistance and will never be able to crush Palestinian resistance. And so these attempts to sort of wipe out the resistance by taking Palestinian lives, by imposing trauma and devastation on families and loved ones and mothers and fathers and brothers and sisters and wives and husbands and children of the martyrs, this is an exercise of brutality. This is an exercise of colonial violence and colonial brutality. But what it has never done and never will do is silence the message and the vision of these martyrs and all of those who continue to fight, which is for the liberation of Palestine from the river to the sea.
Ahmad Mayed, resistance movement Hamas says Israel will pay for its crimes and the Israeli measures will only strengthen Palestinians' resolve to continue their resistance against the regime. Will these Israeli crimes make Palestinians more united in the face of the occupation?
Yes, I agree with the sentiments that have been expressed by Hamas. The attacks against the populations of Jenin, if you look in 2022, of the 70 Palestinians that have been martyred thus far, approximately we're looking at round about 27, I would say, are from Jenin alone. Jenin was always the heart of resistance during the Al-Aqsa Intifada. It was Ariel Sharon, Arik Schreinemann, who called Jenin the cockroach's nest and was renamed by the Palestinians as the nest of angels. It has been the core of resistance. It's in April, it was 20 years since the Jenin massacre. And now Israel is sitting with a very difficult problem. How do they show to their population that they're doing something without sparking a massive regional war? They can't go to Gaza. It is very clear from Saif al-Quds that the escalation, according to them, was not visible through any forms of intelligence or any forms of prediction. And therefore, they're quite afraid of escalating in Gaza, the usual stomping ground of the IDF. So they're trying to do it with periodic attacks into Jenin. And like my colleague has said, is that Jenin is now a symbol of resistance for the Palestinian people, because Israel has also taken some casualties during their raids into Jenin. What we have, and the key to this problem, is the cooperation, the security cooperation between the Palestinian Authority and the Israeli regime. It's not very different from what was happening here in apartheid South Africa and the Bantustans, and that is why you had people like Chris Hani, was the leader of the SACP and the chief of staff of Mkhonto Sizwe, the armed movement of the ANC, together with Ronnie Kasrils in September of 1992, fighting against these puppets of the apartheid regime, saying that they have to remove the parasites. The key to this resistance in the West Bank is to remove the security cooperation with the Israeli state and remove the puppets from their seats. They are working as agents of Israel, and it has not worked in South Africa. They were removed, and this is what needs to happen on the ground in Palestine.
Charlie Cates, the Palestinian Foreign Ministry has also reacted to the recent events. It called on the International Criminal Court to investigate crimes committed by Israeli forces and settlers. Will that ever happen, in your opinion, given the staunch support that the Israelis have from the United States? How can the status quo ever change, in your opinion?
When these crimes are carried out by Israeli occupation forces, it's important to note that these are not Israeli crimes alone. These are not just the crimes of the Zionist regime. These are crimes that are fully funded and backed and supported by the U.S. government, the Canadian government, the governments of the European Union, the governments that not only continue to provide weaponry and advanced technology to the Israeli occupation, but continue to engage in security coordination with it, continue to list Palestinian organizations and Palestinian resistance movements as terrorist organizations, despite the fact that what they are doing is a legitimate exercise of resistance in defense of a colonized people seeking liberation. These governments are part and parcel of the criminal project. They are responsible for these war crimes. So in many ways, if we are expecting, the current governments in the U.S. and Canada and Europe to take the lead in prosecuting Israeli occupation, that's something that we may have a long time to wait for. But what we do see is that within these countries, the people of these countries actually don't agree with what their governments are doing. We see when we look at last year in May 2021 during Saif al-Quds and the Unity Intifada, what did we see in the cities of the world? Thousands, tens of thousands of people pouring into the streets in the heart of the empire to say, we stand with Palestine, no more Israeli apartheid, no more Israeli crimes, no to Zionism, no to racism. And so the fact is that it is very essential, especially for those of us who are in these countries and working to organize for Palestine, to do everything that we can to put meaningful and powerful pressure on these states to cut off the flow of military, diplomatic, economic, and political support and impunity that is being given to the Israeli occupation regime. And so in terms of the International Criminal Court, there are many very distinguished and committed Palestinian and international lawyers that are working to pursue this there. But what we see instead from much of the leadership of the International Criminal Court is an interest in pursuing only African leaders and those who are on the other side from imperialist powers, rather than actually pursuing the major perpetrators of injustice in the world, who are these very imperialist powers who are standing in line with the Israeli occupation state. And so unfortunately, for far too long, the Palestinian foreign ministry, rather than representing the interests of the Palestinian people, has continued to engage in a strategy that seeks to essentially give in to the U.S. and Europe, despite the fact that those powers are funding, promoting, and supporting Zionist colonization in Palestine. The first step that any Palestinian Authority entity can take is to bring an end immediately to the security coordination process, which is putting the Palestinian resistance and the Palestinian people in danger on a daily basis.
Ahmad Mayet, an analyst that we spoke to here on Press TV earlier, also believes that the Palestinians have every right to fight the Israeli occupation and they should be supported in their struggle. You agree with that notion, of course. Are Palestinians receiving the support that they need? And if not, how can that support be enhanced?
The right to resist an occupation is an international law right. That right, if we want to look at any other precedent, South Africa was the perfect precedent. We had the armed struggle here under Mkhonto Sizwe and many other movements. In fact, when Chris Hani was assassinated, the chief of staff of Mkhonto Sizwe, it was the speech of the first democratically elected president of South Africa, the late Nelson Mandela, who said that it's not a question of armed resistance or negotiations. At the time, they were negotiating with the apartheid regime for the end of this horrendous form of governance. He said it's not the decision between armed resistance and negotiations. It is armed resistance that brought the Afrikaner apartheid government to the negotiating table. Therefore, it's indicative of the fact that you cannot exclude the armed resistance from the equation, which many are trying to do through different means. And this is the very serious threat that is now presenting itself. Armed resistance is a cornerstone of the Palestinian movement. It is the key to the liberation of Palestine. We've had negotiations for many years, and what has that produced? It's produced eaten up Palestinian land, more settlements, further oppression, and periodic attacks against the Palestinians. What we have now is an axis of resistance stretching all the way from the borders of Pakistan, going through into Afghanistan. You have the Islamic Republic of Iran that has bolstered the Palestinians' ability to defend themselves and to actually stand up and assert their rights. And that is what we saw with Saif al-Quds. We saw the reclamation of dignity, and this axis has gone far beyond. It's gone to Iraq. It is on the borders of Syria, looking into Golan. We have it in Lebanon with Hezbollah, and we have it in the south with Gaza, and even far as Ansarullah in Yemen. The armed resistance is going to be the key to the liberation of the Palestinian people, as together with movements such as boycott, divestment, and sanction, and more so not the movement, but rather the tool of boycott, divestment, and sanction, and global support. However, we cannot shy away from the right of oppressed people to defend themselves. This is not an offensive war, it's a defensive war. And I think that reality is very clear. It was proven in South Africa, and it is now proven in Palestine.
Charlotte Cates, more land confiscations and evictions are taking place by the Israelis. It was just announced yesterday, if I'm correct, that the regime is planning to confiscate a vast swath of Palestinian land in the occupied West Bank, around 1,000 square kilometers of Palestinian territory from Al-Quds all the way to the Dead Sea, in what's being viewed as its largest expansionist program. Under international law, we know the Israeli judicial system has no legal authority over the population it occupies. Human Rights Watch, for example, has said on numerous occasions that Israel's policies amount to apartheid and crimes against humanity. And why are these policies still continuing then?
These policies are continuing because they are being funded and backed by very powerful imperialist states. The Israeli occupation regime, the Zionist project in Palestine, would cease to exist if U.S. imperialism cut off the endless flow of money and protective support that it provides to this project. And in fact, this is something that the Zionist Project is very concerned about. When we see all of these propaganda campaigns, campaigns of criminalization, campaigns of targeting Palestine organizing in the United States and internationally, one of the reasons for this is that it's very clear that young people, that progressive people, that people in general who want to see a more just world and a just society to recognize that Zionism is racism, and that Israeli settler colonialism, that Zionist colonization of Palestine is something that simply cannot be part of a just world and a just society. And so for those of us that are working for justice outside occupied Palestine, one of the most important things that we can do is everything that we can to put pressure on these governments that are continuing to fund, support, and arm the occupation regime, to hold them accountable for their crimes against the Palestinian people, and to organize to defend the Palestinian people and their resistance for the liberation of Palestine from the river to the sea. Because the Palestinian resistance is on the front lines fighting back, not just for the liberation of Palestine, but really for a just and democratic future for humanity, sure, which is something that cannot coexist with apartheid, settler colonialism, occupation, and oppression.
Ahmed Maed, you heard the plans, the most recent plans of the Israeli regime of more land confiscations. What are the Israelis achieving with this land grab policy? Apart from Judaization of Palestinian land, are the Israelis also deliberately sabotaging any prospects of an independent Palestinian state in the future?
The framework has changed drastically from a two-state discussion to a one-state reality. The Israeli confiscations of large tracts of land right now is an attempt to establish facts on the ground so that when they are forced to the table to discuss the dismantlement of the state, they have more to deal with than being put into a position where they are forced to accept the precepts of international law. what is happening now within the human rights discourse is that the very foundations of Israel is being questioned. You have it from Human Rights Watch, you have it from Amnesty International, and you have it from B'Tselem, to name a few. The establishment of the State of Israel was based on the principles of terror, it was based on ethnic superiority, and it is a state that favors only one group of people. It is hardly democratic, its very foundations are flawed, and therefore it has to be dismantled. Israel knows this, and this is why Israel is acting in the manner it is acting. It is very similar to the manner in which the apartheid regime behaved towards the end of its life. Israel is now facing a situation where the military equation has changed, because any attempt to jihadize the precincts of Masjid al-Aqsa and Jerusalem al-Quds will now create a regional war. And that regional war will overwhelm Israel. In fact, this is the latest statements from the Israeli military leaders. They are aware of that. And therefore, they are trying to gain whatever advantage they can by stealing tracts of land, by building settlements, etc., in a gray zone principle, meaning that they are trying to push the parameters as far as they can without sparking a war. This is gray zone tactics from Israel, but the clock is rather ticking, and Israel is running out of time. It's very, very clear. This is not our comments. This is not from a pro-Palestinian or Palestinian supporter comment. It is a situation that is coming out from Israeli military reports. They are saying that this is not a sustainable project, and apartheid was not sustainable, colonialism was not sustainable, and the Israeli Zionist project is not sustainable. It is basically the end of Israel, and these are the last kicks of a dying horse.
All right, that brings us to an end here on this edition of our program. Allow me to thank my guests, attorney, activist, and political analyst Zakir Ahmadmaya, joining us from Johannesburg, and thanks to international coordinator Tsamadun Palestinian Prisoner Solidarity Network Charlotte Cates, joining us from Vancouver, and also special thanks to you for staying with us on tonight's Spotlight.
Bye, everybody.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This is Foresight. a program on how to worship Allah.
Allah, Allah, Allah.
Today's tip, what is the result of worship that is conducted for the sake of Allah with a pure and happy, content heart when it comes to our ubudiyah, our servitude to Allah?
Allah, Allahu Rabbi, la sharika lahu.
So, dear friends, we are talking about this idea that what will come about when we conduct our worship and we conduct our ubudiyah, whether it is our du'as or our supplications, with a pure heart, with a pure intention, and with a content and happy heart. Now, of course, as we had said in certain previous programs, when we do our worship with a pure intention and with a pure heart, with a soul that is tranquil and at ease, with eagerness, with zest, wanting to do these prayers, then the result will be positive when it comes to our spirituality and our ubudiyah to Allah. Such kind of worship will bring luminosity to the heart, and the inside and the depths of the soul will react, and they will change, and the image of servitude, the image of ubudiyah, will become ingrained within the inner heart and the depths of the heart. And as we have said, that the aim of worship is that the depths of the soul and the depths of the heart should become this very image of servitude, this image of ubudiyah. But in order for a luminosity to be created in the heart, and in order for the soul to react, and in order, of course, for the image of ubudiyah and servitude to be ingrained and written upon the depths of the heart and the depths of the soul, we must do our ubudiyah and our worship and our du'as and our litanies and our dhikr, our remembrance of Allah and our tasbih, our glorification of Allah, with a pure heart and with a pure intention and with eagerness and with this cheerfulness of heart and soul, wanting to be of service in the ubudiyah to Allah.
Ya Allah, Ya Allah, Ya Allah, Ya Allah, Ya Mannan,
haqqiq amani. IRIB English Radio.
Our website is parstoday.com.
Ya Allah, Ya Rahman, haqqiq amanina, waffiqna fi kulli an, fi ma sa'ina. Ya Allah, Ya Mannan, haqqiq amanina. أجب دعائي يا رجائي بالرضا والخير أنر طريقي مع صديقي باحترام الغير.
Allah is the unique Arabic name for the one true God. He is the only one worthy of worship, with no rivals, equals, or partners. Allah is not like His creation, as nothing shares His divine essence and attributes, such as being the Creator, the Provider, the Most Merciful, the All-Powerful, the Most Just, the All-Wise, and the All-Knowing. Allah is without partner or equal in His authority and actions. The world was created by Allah's command alone. He runs the world and controls it all alone. Muslims believe that Allah is one, indivisible, and unequal in His divinity and knowledge. He does not have any ancestors, nor does He have descendants, and He is without wife, partner, or offspring. None came before Him, and He is in no need of any angel, prophet, or saint. Of all the sins committed by His creation, none is greater than than the act of shirk, which is the Arabic word for associating partners with Allah. In the Islamic tradition, Allah has 99 names, which include the most loving, the friend, the most kind, and the most powerful. Allah can be translated in English language as the one and only God.
IRIB English Radio.
Our website is parstoday.com.